Hey, Taylor.
Hey, girl.
Today, we have somebody who leads from the heart.
Oh, I see what you did there.
That's very clever.
We have Mike from the White Heart, and there are also some other hearts attached to that business. What's the White Heart for people who may not live in our community?
White Heart is Lynchburg's living room. It's, you know, our mission is to curate connection, to cultivate change, and do that. And one of the ways we do that is through what I call tables, and that's just spaces because people connect when they get together. Coffee makes that easy. Food, you know, you have a reason to get together. You spend time eating together. Then there's that natural point of connection. So we like to create those spaces that are, you know, conducive to that. And that's what we do with White Heart. So,
what brought you to Lynchburg?
Because you're not native to Lynchburg, are you?
No, been here 6 years, a little over 6 years. It was Labor Day 2018 that my family moved here. I actually moved here about a month and a half ahead of my family to build out the loft that we lived in for the first 3 years that we were here downtown. And so for me, it's been a little bit longer than that. Yeah, 6 years. What brought us to Lynchburg? I love that question. People ask that question all the time.
Really?
And I found out early on, there's really two types of people in Lynchburg. It's
nosy people.
Born and raised. Nosy people. Born and raised in Lynchburg, and a lot of them really just can't wait to get out kind of thing, which I think is typical for like home. It's a hometown sickness, whatever, right? But then the second is people who landed here, and some of them don't really even understand how, you know? It's like, we just ended up here. Similar to our story, we left Texas, and there's so much more context to this. I'll spare you all the details. I love to share the story because it's so full of like just uncanny things that you can't explain. I believe to be divine, but we left Texas without knowing where we were going, and that's all we knew was we were supposed to leave.
That sounds like a country song. We left Texas.
I've written lots of songs about it. In fact, I have a whole series of songs I'd love to get in the studio with at one point called that I just call Songs from the Wilderness. Mm-hmm. You leave kind of the land of your ancestors, so to speak, or the family, or where your comfort. We were there in Texas, my wife and I, for each of us individually for over 30 years. So not just the life we had together, but the life we had apart was all there. Mm-hmm. And so you leave that. And you don't know where you're going. You enter into this space of the unknown, the unfamiliar, and now you're trying to figure out where we're going. We got four boys, and you know we don't have a job waiting for us. We don't have a network. We don't have any. You know, we kind of started going, okay, well, where are we supposed to go? And started looking at like Nashville, where her family is, or some of her family is, like Denver, where I've got some good friends there, and. You know, none of it felt right. And then one thing after another, just uncanny. Lynchburg just kept coming on the radar. We didn't know anything about Lynchburg. We didn't know anybody here. We didn't know. I'd heard of Liberty. I didn't even realize what Liberty was. Like, oh, it's just another university. I had no clue the size of it. And that it's, you know, it's evangelical ties and things like that. Like this is all of the thing that is Liberty was completely, that a lot of people think you end up in Lynchburg, end up here because of Liberty somehow. And it really wasn't that wasn't us at all. We had no idea until we got here. But just one thing after another. I mean, literally on the other side of the world, we're in Queenstown, New Zealand with friends of ours. And we walk into this shop and we'd already kind of like Lynchburg had come to the forefront somehow. I don't even remember how. It's like, oh, Lynchburg, we should maybe check that out. I don't know. Don't know anything about Lynchburg, whatever. And, walk into the shop and the girl didn't have a Kiwi accent. So like, oh, where are you from? You know, she's like, oh, I was raised in this little town. You've probably never heard of it. It was in Lynchburg, Virginia. I was like, what?
No way.
No kidding. 5 minutes later.
I love things like that.
Isn't that wild? We walk out of there. 5 minutes later, we get a call from my wife's brother, oldest brother who lives in Alexandria. And he's like, oh man, there's this family you need to meet. They're really, you know, think along the same lines as you guys and blah, 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 blah. They live in Lynchburg, Virginia. So right there, just boom, boom. It just became obvious. Like, we need to go check this out. And so then we did. And again, one thing after another, series of uncanny events that just opened up doors, and it became apparent this is where we needed to go. And I say apparent. There was never any certainty. Like there was always doubt. Like, how do you walk out into the unknown and be sure that that's where you're supposed to be?
And you know? Said kind of casually that you have four boys, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Is there ever any certainty when you're raising four boys of various ages? You know, I'm thinking about I'm in the throes of parenting adolescents, and I'm not so sure there's certainty in that season. So you probably didn't have a whole lot of certainty.
I think certainty, yeah. It's hard to gauge where you are right now when you're looking at the past or the future. And this other thing, I think both very important to keep in perspective, but you really find assuredness and certainty, you know, when you really evaluate where you are. Like, man, I'm not so sure about what we've done to this point in parenting, or I'm not so sure how we're going to get to the mm-hmm. next point in parenting, but like right now we're doing like I'm just so grateful. Like mm-hmm. I've got some good relationships with my kids, and mm-hmm. you know, and then when that disrupts, then you go back and go, okay, trace back. I know we've done this well in the past. And you remember, you know, and I think that's kind of the journey of life in general. You have to kind of hold those things in perspective all along the way. But for us, yeah, there was no certainty. Actually, you mentioned the kids. I'm going to tell this story real quick because I love this story. I learned more from my kids than from anybody else, period.
I love that.
God. And it's time, you know, sometimes it's like, you know, times you don't want to hear it, but a lot of times it's precious and it's beautiful. And there was a time about 8 months out, I think, maybe a year. So my son, who's 16 now, was 10 years old at the time. And I went back. I had worked at a church there, and they invited us back to do the Easter gathering there. I think I did some music with him or something like that. But I took him with me because he was the oldest. He had the most friends. There's more of his life that was uprooted than the other kids. And so he came back with me, and we go to the church. And, man, it was just this beautiful, like, just everybody that – seeing everybody again. And he was connecting with his old buddies and just had a good time. And it was so cool. And we're driving away from the church just kind of with that glow, right? It's hard for me to tell. It still gets me emotional because I'm driving, and as hard as it's been on me, right, I'm watching my kids process this, and we're driving away, about to go to another friend's house that we've done Easter with for the last several years. And I was like, hey, you know, we're talking about, oh, yeah, I got to see so-and-so, so-and-so. And I asked him a question. I was just like, it was good to see everybody again, huh? And silence. And I look up in the rear mirror, and he's, you know, I said, man, I want you to know the same emotion. I still feel this. Like, I want you to know, like, I'm sorry, because I know you had no choice. You had no choice, and we uprooted you out of your life, and I'm sorry. I know that's hard. 10 years old. He says, Dad, you didn't have a choice either. Even at that age, perceived that there was something bigger than us, something beyond our circumstances that told us we needed to go, and we just had to. And I think I told you the other day, nothing's hard when you don't have a choice, right? But it's like, that stuck with me for so many years. Like, man, that's the certainty. It's mm-hmm. like, how does a 10-year-old know
to say that,
to have that kind of certainty and confidence to be able to say that to his dad? Like, that's the kind of stuff that brings me certainty mm-hmm. about that whole journey.
I feel like I'm going to bring up a Taylorism every episode because the first time I heard her say it on an episode, it struck me. And I think you need to say it to Mike about what we just talked about with joy, because I think what you're describing there is that you can be homesick and grateful for your new home at mm-hmm. the same time. So say what you say.
Yeah. So basically, when I was going to college, I'm one of the people who came to Lynchburg through Liberty. A month before I went to college for the first time, one of my friends passed away in a car accident. Mm-hmm. And so it was just kind of, you know, the world gets bigger when you are in a set, like you're in a mental space where like you're seeing in a world with a sense of cruelty. Mm-hmm. And that kind of continued throughout my college years. But then, you know, I was able to make all these friends, so many wonderful relationships. I ended up really struggling with my mind at a time where a lot of my friends were getting married. I was in a lot of weddings. So there's so much to work through personally, but there's always a reason to celebrate. Mm-hmm. So I like to say that life is everything all at once, and it always will be. Mm. So whenever there is hard, there is also joy. Whenever there is joy, there is also hard.
That's really good. I like that a lot. And it took me a minute when you said that. I was like, I'm not sure I'm tracking it. As soon as you said that, next one, it's always there. Mm-hmm. You have the choice. That's the thing I think, man, our culture really struggles with. And I think this is where I lean into with coaching. Like when I coach people, like I'm not giving you something you don't have. I don't have any joy to give you. I don't have any hope to give you. I don't have any whatever. You have it already. Mm-hmm. It's there. I'm just going to help you make that choice. I'm going to help you discover it. I'm going to help you find it.
It's a choice.
And it is. That's a really great way to put it. Life is everything all at once. There's also a movie called that, isn't there?
Maybe. It's like everything everywhere all at once.
Yes,
know,
yes,
like
yes.
That. Yeah. I heard of that movie and I was like, wait a second.
They stole my line.
They took it.
You should send them a bill.
Yeah.
The percentage of
invoice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Another guest talked about he thought his style of leadership was to push people out of their nest because they know how to fly.
Mm.
And what you're talking about is you can fly.
Mm-hmm.
We have the innate ability to fly in various ways. And he talked about he felt his part as a leader was pushing someone out of the nest, but also saying, I'm your safety net. So I hear some parallels in what you're talking about. You can't be someone else's joy, just like you can't fly for them.
That's something I'm learning a lot because I have that deep desire to help people, to rescue people, to save people, you know. And just through certain relational experiences over the last year or so, I've just learned a lot about like that I need that mentality. Like just push them out of the nest sometimes, you know, like I want to be like, you know, help them down, help them, you know. And it's funny because as a father, I'm that way. I'm like, let the boy fall on the bike. He'll be all right.
That's
you
how
know?
They learn.
And so I'm not that way naturally as a father, but with people somehow, I somehow lost that dynamic. I actually wrote a song not too long ago about that called Save Yourself. And it's a play on words. It's Savior, S-A-V-I-O-R, self, and save yourself. And the idea is essentially, you have the ability to do it yourself. You are in a sense capable of being your own savior in a way. Not that we don't need other people, that we don't need a savior outside of ourselves, but in the sense that like you have the capacity yourself.
You're so much more capable than you think.
Yeah. And that's the chorus line is I'm nobody's savior, so save yourself.
Mm.
You know, that's and I had to push this for me. It's a conversation with myself because it's really me going like I'm not people's savior.
Mm-hmm.
And I gotta stop trying to act like one.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway. Yeah.
That's a hard lesson that I feel like people in this community and beyond need to hear. I certainly do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so interesting that you say you're not like that as a parent, because I'm not either. But if I think that people are incredibly vulnerable, I won't push them out of the nest. I'll bring the food to the nest.
Mm-hmm.
I'll build your nest. Mm-hmm. I'll overcompensate to the point where I have a wise mentor who said we're loving people to failure. And I know in my past that I've loved people to failure.
Mm-hmm.
And we live in a region that I don't think is unique from other regions. So I want this to be generalizable. Mm. But we live in a region, specifically a city, that has 500 churches. And there are probably as many or more nonprofits. So we live, you came to your new home where so many people are fixers and helpers and saviors.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is done for a higher savior, but you live in a region where it's really common to do that, to be that helper.
That was one of the things when I first came here, going back kind of the question of how we came to Lynchburg. When I moved here ahead of my family, again, knew nothing about Lynchburg at all, but very quickly started to learn, wait, there's 450 churches here? Mm-hmm. Wait, there's the biggest evangelical university on the planet is here? Like, I got mad. I remember one day, because, you know, you already start, I'm away from my family. I'm doing construction from sunrise to sundown, trying to build this loft out.
You mean the wilderness wasn't comfortable for you?
It was very uncomfortable. It was lonely. I started feeling sorry for myself one day. I was just like, I don't want to do this. Like, this is, and it was based on that coming to knowledge, like, well, they don't need me here. Why am I here? Like, in my mind, this is my conversation with God. And I have very authentic conversations with God. I'm like, God, why'd you bring me here? Mm-hmm. You messed up. Like, this is not for me. And there's reasons beyond just that they don't need me here. I grew up with a chip on my shoulder against Christians, mm-hmm. for one. But I was like, God, you don't need me here. And I was feeling sorry for myself. And I got done for the day and I went for a walk. And this is all downtown. So I go on the Bluff Walk down. I'm like, I'm just going to get a burger and a beer and feel sorry for myself. And that was kind of my mindset. I don't know if you guys ever get into those places.
Oh, yeah.
It's very, very mature.
Yeah, really healthy.
So I'm walking down the Bluff Walk. I'm like, I'm going to go. I saw this place, whatever that place is up at the top of the, that has the burgers and stuff. I can't remember what it's called now. But anyway.
Bootleggers?
Yes, bootleggers. Yeah. I was like, but something prompted me mm-hmm. to not go there. So I went down the stairs, went down the lower part on Jefferson Street and walked back. And there's Water Dog. I walk mm-hmm. into Water Dog. And I go sit down at the bar, and there's, you know, of course, all of these seats here, there's like one or two people sitting on the long side of the bar, and there's one seat on the corner. I was like, I got a good chance I don't have to talk to somebody if I sit in this one seat right here. So I did. And I was just like, whatever. Well, this lady walks in, and she sits down catty corner from me, and
starts a conversation.
And I'm just like, ugh. And as much as I'm like, in my own pity and wallowing in myself,
I'm in a bad mood,
I
ma'am.
Still have like this compassion for people, right? So it draws me into conversation. She's there. She starts telling, I don't know why, she starts telling me about her husband has cheated on her again the second time and blah, 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 and this and that. I'm looking for some sympathy or something. And I don't know what came over me. Let's just call it the Spirit of God, right? Came over me. And I said, I think you should stay with him. And she looked like, what? And so that opened up this, again, I was one of the things, I opened my mouth and things just start coming out. And I started just telling her about what I believe about a savior that came for me, and that while I was in it, in the mess, and that love is what compels me to live a better life, and, you know, so on and so forth. And I'm not saying that was the right advice to give her per se, but one of the things that she's like, her jaw drops as I'm telling her what I know to be true about this Jesus. She's just like, she has no words. And she says this: born and raised in Lynchburg, Virginia, a town of 500 churches. I've never heard of Jesus like that before.
Wow. At a bar.
At a bar. And it was like, and, you know, at some point I wrapped it up. It's like, hey, I don't know if I ever see you again, but praying for you. Hope this works out. I leave. And it's just that overwhelming sense of God's like, that's why I have you here. And there's a very specific.
To be the church, not necessarily in the church.
To be a different perspective. There's something I think that's missed. We get kind of, I've been saying the greatest threat to progress in a community, and let's just say from a spiritual perspective, the greatest threat to the kingdom is not destruction. You know, we often talk about in Christian circles the steal, kill, and destroy MO. And I think that's actually not talking about spiritual force. That's actually talking about false teachers. But when you think about like the MO is the steal, kill, and destroy, we're like, oh yeah, they're trying to destroy. And I told this to somebody today. I said the greatest threat to progress in any community and to growth and to healing and so on and so forth is not destruction. It's distraction. Mm. And because why would, if you really believe there is a opposition, an adversary trying to oppose good in the world and progress in the world, why would that force destroy you if he can let you be distracted instead, then you'll distract everybody around you. And this happens a lot, we'll just say, in election season, mm-hmm. right? Well, a lot of people were distracted over the last mm-hmm. several months. Mm-hmm. And honestly, still a lot of that happening. But I think that that's something to be very guarded against is we're distracted. We're distracted. And that's how somebody can be born and raised in a town of 500 churches and never heard what I understand to be like the pure yeah. message of the gospel that churches are supposed Jesus. To be saying.
Mm-hmm. And maybe they did.
And maybe they did. But a lot of times, sometimes I say, you know, we can't hear you for the volume, mm-hmm. for the noise. Mm-hmm. We can't hear you for the noise. There's a lot of noise that comes with it. There's judgment. There's whether that's actual judgment or perceived judgment, right? Mm-hmm. But whatever the noise is, we can't hear the truth for the noise. And that's why I'm passionate about just helping people see what's already there. Like you said, everything's already there. Mm-hmm. It's already there. I'm not giving you something you don't have. Mm-hmm. I'm helping you see what's already there. And that was a really powerful moment for me and has been a sort of North Star moving forward in the 6 years I've been here is, no, there is a space for me here that despite the chip on my shoulder that I grew up with, I call it evangelizing Christians. That's a calling for me.
Life is messy, and sometimes people just need someone safe to talk to. We're here to listen because everyone's story should be heard. 518 Counseling exists to empower children, adults, and families to overcome past experiences and create a path to being stronger both mentally and spiritually. Family is a nuanced concept. 518's family care team brings simple solutions to complex situations through professional intervention, interpersonal support, and parenting education. We strive for an outcome of mending families and keeping children safe. 518's Connect team equips and empowers volunteers with the training and support to serve confidently by matching their passions with opportunities. Our outreach is targeted to build partnerships with individuals, churches, agencies, and businesses. At Hat Creek Camp, we provide exceptional camp experiences with careful attention to the needs of youth, encouraging campers to grow through trust-based challenges and successes. It's a place to build relationships, inspire change, and transform lives.
So what led you to be the owner of a local coffee shop? And it's more than a coffee shop. Like you said, it's Lynchburg's living room. And what else do you do as jobs? I've known you to have a few jobs.
Yeah. So White Hart is obviously the cafe there. That started as just coffee distribution. It started with partnerships in other countries where we're seeing, you know, development happening, but we're asking the question, How do we do this sustainably and long term? Because it's the when helping hurts thing, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of models, short term models that go in, and it's like, man, we've been in this community for 30 years, and we celebrate that. And we're like, wait a minute, why are we still there? Do they still need us? Like, something's wrong if they still need us after 30 years. They're still at the same level of poverty. They're still at the same level of dependency on something outside. Like, we're creating a problem now. So how can we help develop these communities long-term and more sustainably? And the answer just became more and more clear that business is how you do that. You create jobs, you invest in the local economy. You know, a simple example would be, rather than bringing a bunch of shoes for kids, which I've been on those trips, I've seen people, I put the shoes on the kids. Well, the local shoe guy in that community can't compete with free. You're putting him out of business. You're actually hurting that community, right? So instead, why don't we bring our resources and invest in a local business and buy shoes from him, you know, to provide for those kids? So that's just one example, but a lot of it was like, hey, how can we best develop and support people who are already invested in this community rather than coming in as the saviors again, right? And so as much as we can, we work with some importers that we know, we trust that they're using ethical practices, that they're invested in the communities where they get their coffee from. Or we do what's just called direct trade coffee. We go and we directly source this coffee from a place we've been on the farm. We know the people who run them. We have those relationships. And so as much as we're able to do that, we do. And that's where it started. And then opportunity came up to purchase White Hart, and was sort of the thought was, well, if we want to buy coffee from these communities and support these communities, we got to be able to sell the coffee. And so let's build the market side. And so about White Hart, and then COVID hit, and mm-hmm. we weren't traveling anywhere. And mm-hmm. so there was no more going and sourcing coffee. So now it's like, oh, let's focus on building this. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of our energy has been on White Hart for the last several years, but have now in the last couple of years really started working on building back to, that origin and the sourcing. So I'm actually going to Guatemala Monday. I'll be there for mm-hmm. 2 weeks to work on some of that. But that's kind of where it all started. And that's what we do with White Hart. Now, personally, what I do, I can't just work a job for the sake of a paycheck. I'm miserable in that kind of role. Like, there has to be a purpose behind it. And so, I'm always looking at, like, what's my role in this community and how do I, you know, what do I care about? Always been connected to education. Was a teacher for about 7 years in different capacities. Worked some for the 21st Century Grant after school programming in Texas, and as well as a classroom teacher. And got out of that for a lot of reasons, but just there's things I'm really good at with kids and with students, and the things I wasn't good at was dominating me. And so I was like, okay, I need to find another way. But I've always had a heart for public education specifically, not just education. I am big on education, but specifically public education, because there's always going to be a portion of our population that depends on that. And that's their, as much, if not even greater in many ways, the part of the future of this community.
Yeah.
And if we neglect that, then we're neglecting to invest in our future. So been very much invested in the public school system. My boys all go to public school.
That's how I first heard of you, because you were a skateboarding parent, right?
You know, what's funny is I didn't start skateboarding until I moved here. I'd never done skateboarding when I was a kid.
Well, it was interesting.
It was very dangerous.
The first time I ever heard of you was because you were skateboarding to school, right? To pick one of the boys up, or I don't know why.
Probably more downtown. Mm-hmm. The hill up to Dunbar and R.S. Payne is not something that I would ever do a skateboard with, down or up. Okay. Some people go down. I'm not on that level. But I think it may be the gym that we trained at. We would skateboard from our house to the gym at Renaissance Academy. And so, yeah, I did pick that up for a time, mm-hmm. mostly in solidarity for my boys than anything. But I do walk my boys to school every Tuesday and Thursday now. And the reason it's Tuesday and Thursday is because the other mornings, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I drive a bus. So I started driving a school bus. This came from a place of partly needing to supplement as we build out and kind of restructured some of the White Hart management. I realized I don't need to be the one managing, because I'm not a great cafe manager. But I had people that were, and so I was shuffling some of the money that way. I needed to supplement my income, and I thought, well, I'm not just going to go do something, any old thing. What is something that I could do? And I kept getting calls. First of all, every day I got a call, buses, such and such and such and such and such are going to be 30 minutes late, hour late, hour and a half late. And I'm like, good grief. What's going on with the transportation? Like, we have these buses getting kids to school late. Like, that's major disruption to their routine and their learning environment. And, you know, you got kids coming into class while the class is already in the task. I mean, it's just, mm-hmm. it's a nightmare. If you're a teacher in that kind of environment, I knew enough to be in the classroom. Like, when kids come midway through class, especially if there's a number of them,
mm-hmm.
oh my gosh, it's so disruptive. And it's so hard to kind of, you work really hard to create an environment
that
helps them
focus.
It's a major distraction, right? And it's a problem. And so I kept getting those phone calls, and I was like, man, I maintained a Class B CDL, which is a passenger endorsement. I maintained that for just thinking I might use it someday and didn't really know when. I've had it for 15 years. And I was like, I have a Class B CDL. I could help. But then I was like, I was kind of checking myself. Is this just my savior complex? I had a friend of mine, actually Dr. Glover. You might know him, Chris Glover. He's a principal now at Fort Hill and worked with Beacon of Hope for years. One of my good friends, and he's like, yeah, that's that savior. I was like, no, I don't think so, because I checked it. I checked it for about 3 months, because I kept thinking about it.
You
got to
give it enough time.
Yeah. I was like, nah, they don't, you know, I don't need to insert myself there. You know, there's schedule restraints. It's like, man, that's every day, early morning. I've got, you know, in afternoon, I've got stuff I've got to do, and, you know, I don't want to disrupt that, and, you know, it's extra time away from my family, and, you know, all of the different things. And so, but every day I would take my son to EC Glass, and there's a big bus out there with a sign, drivers needed or drivers wanted or something. Mm-hmm. I kept seeing it. So finally one day I was like, all right, I'm going to call. And I called and, you know, wasted no time getting me in for an interview and getting me into the process. And longer story, a little shorter. I ended up signing on to drive a school bus. And in my mind, there's different reasons, that brought me to that. Obviously, just that the compulsion that I couldn't get away from, but recognizing the real problem it was for our transportation to be that sporadic, and what that created, the issues that created in the school system and for these kids. And the kids, again, kids that are dependent on, not all of them, but a lot of them that are dependent on transportation are the ones that are at risk, as we might call them, you know, that are at risk of not getting the support they need, or for whatever reason, their parents are working two jobs and each, and they can't get them to school. And so, you know, it's our most vulnerable that often depend on that resource. And so I thought, man, I can at least chip in and help by driving a bus. But then there was also a sense of curiosity. It's like looking from the inside, what's really going on? Why are these problems happening? I sat down with Hope Watts, who's the director of transportation for LCS. She is a logistics genius and loves it. I mean, absolutely loves it. But she gave me some insight as to why. I sat down with her, I was like, tell me what's going on. And she told me that, you know, that it's really boils down to just drivers. We need drivers. We need people to drive buses. And so since then, learning kind of, and there's some other things too. I think there are some perceived barriers that can be addressed. I think there's some actual barriers that can be addressed. But overall, we just need people to know, like, hey, we need people. Mm-hmm. And so I'm on a mission now to get bus drivers, because this shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah.
This really shouldn't be a problem.
I love the idea of, and I've said this for a number of years, how you saw the need, how many people could pick up a route. It's almost like the 1940s or 1950s get a paper route.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many people could pick up a route and do their other job?
Mm-hmm.
Or how many other people have that level of flexibility? And there are so many, you know, you've said saviors. There are so many fixers and helpers and folks who want to be a part of the solution in this community who really could pick up a bus route. It's a way to mentor. It's a way to minister to people.
My dad has started driving a school bus as well.
Good for him.
Yeah. So he, for him, I haven't really
for
talked
LCS
to him.
Or for one of the
no,
counties?
No, so I'm from Pennsylvania.
Okay,
so
got
he's
you in Pennsylvania.
Like, he's driving outside of Philly. But I don't know the specific motivation behind it, other than he loves a side hustle and he loves an errand.
Uh-huh.
Like, he's an errand guy.
Yeah.
So if anyone's listening to this and you don't necessarily feel that same like strong like heart call to be a bus driver, if you like running errands, it could be a good fit.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I wish I've been thinking about like, what is my sales pitch to people? It's really, there's not a whole lot to sell it, because it's not necessarily the best paying job, and it's not, you know, there are certain schedules. You got to get up early if you're driving in the morning, you know, that kind of stuff. And let's be real, like, the kids are kids. And I know every single one of those kids' names, and I call them. I say hi to them by name every time they get on the bus, and I say bye to them every time they get off the bus. Maybe three of them know my name or even care. Or even respond. It's getting better. Like, there's more and more. Like, I have a little bit more rapport and interaction. But
you're so in the seeds.
But it's not necessarily, I say that to say, it's not necessarily relationally rewarding. You're right. You're not going to get that warm, fuzzy glow from the kids most of the time. Yeah. But when you can think about it in terms of, it's not about what I'm getting back, but what really is being sown into these kids, you're the first person they see.
And you're showing up.
And you're there. Consistently, yep. Right? You're the last person a lot of them see before they go back to home, whatever mm-hmm. home is like, right? And I know for me, you know, I played every sport imaginable because I didn't want to go home, right? Mm-hmm. So some of these kids, they don't want to go home. And so you're the last thing, you're saying the last thing that you know, they'll hear before they enter into that environment. That's powerful. Mm-hmm. That's powerful.
So you've mentioned a chip on your shoulder when it comes to Christianity.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a way that you're comfortable with. You can tell me to shut up. You can tell me not to ask this question.
I'm an open book.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. What do you mean when you say you had a chip on your shoulder when it comes to Christians, and how do you get to where you are now?
In a simple answer, I equated, for the most part, my experience growing up, if you were a Christian, you were a bully. Mm. And so I experienced a lot of bullying growing up, and most of it came from kids at church. Or I mentioned, you know, I tried to stay out of the house as much as possible. In my neighborhood, I'd go to whatever vacation Bible school any church was offering. I was like, I'm going to figure out a way to get to all of them. I want to go to all of them, right?
You were that kid.
I was that kid. I was at everyone, because I did not want to be at home, right? So I'm in this, in these spaces, experiencing a lot of bullying for a lot of different reasons. The neighborhood I grew up in, I was one of like two white kids. And mm-hmm. so there was times when literally I would get bullied because I was the white kid. And what am I going to do? Right. So I had that experience, which is interesting. I've always thought it interesting because I perceived somehow as a kid that at that I didn't develop any kind of racial like mm-hmm. issue, like racism of any kind. Like I saw that even with eyes of compassion as a kid, I understood that was just kind of being passed along to mm-hmm. me from what they had experienced, you know?
And you were different.
Right. Right. Or just recognizing mm-hmm. that there was a very distinct difference. And I was an easy target in that regard. But the most malicious, like, bullying consistently came from church kids. Mm. And so, And honestly, even experienced it some from, like, you know, there's this, oof, I don't want to go too far into this because I think it's very prevalent right now. There's a sense that because we're so convinced that we're right, we can be bullies about it and malicious about it. And we can call names and we can point fingers and because we're right.
Right.
And I despise that.
I
push against that so hard. We see a lot of that, again, in the political climate. There's mm-hmm. a lot of crossover right now between evangelicalism and politics. And anyway, yep. I won't get too far into that. But a lot of that, what I feel about that comes from my experience being in that environment.
Weaponizing something that should feel like love, but didn't.
Yep. Yep. Because it's an attempt to dehumanize people. If I can dehumanize you, you're not one of us. You're not really. You're a nothing. You're a nobody. If I can convince other people of that, convince myself of that, and convince you of that, then I can do whatever I want because you're not really of value, you know.
And hearing you say that, I'm reminded of some work that I did in the youth space just a few years ago. And I'll never forget a conversation, and it was with Laura Hamilton from Beacon of Hope, who is so wise. And she said, we love to have enemies. Mm-hmm. And I'd never thought about it. You know, think about high school rivalries. Mm-hmm. Think about sports teams. I mean, I think you all have a fantasy football thing, and it's pretty big. Think about coffee shops. Mm-hmm. Think about, we love to have rivals. And mm-hmm. so one of my favorite movements right now, it's actually a book, it's called Rooting for Rivals. How do we look past differences and realize we're all going to have to come together for something bigger than us.
You know, when it came to even Christianity, it's like I never faltered in my desire to follow God. I just wasn't going to do it like these people were. Mm-hmm. And I don't have a whole lot of space for the mindsets and the products of that way of doing things. It took me a long time to get to a place where I don't see people, Christians, as the enemy. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me sometimes. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I really struggle with the way I see people hold the same name that I hold. And so I have to guard against that. It's not the person. That's the enemy. There's something else bigger. And that's what I want to push against. And that's why I want to. That's why I call it evangelizing Christians. Like, if you act a certain way or don't act a certain way and you ascribe to the things you say you ascribe to, then you must have forgotten.
Yeah, I think there's a very big,
or you were mistaught.
Yeah.
I think there's a very big difference between Jesus and the church.
Has to be. Well,
you know, and what are the rules of the church, or the unspoken rules of the church?
I even had to get to a place where, because it did become sort of like this anti-church sentiment. Not to the point where, again, I mean, I worked in a church, mm-hmm. but we were a very different kind of church. Mm-hmm. And there was even this tendency within that context for people to get this anti-other church
right.
sentiment. You
it
know?
Happened.
And it's all over the place. And so I had to start to recognize there was actually, I think it was actually when I moved to Lynchburg, when I first came to Lynchburg, I was here for my family. And I was like, you know, my buddy of mine that's now in Pennsylvania, he was a doctor up in Charlottesville, and we've been best friends since middle school. And so we connected, he came over here, and we were trying a couple of different churches out, you know, and went to some church and went in there, and the preacher just bashed the church, you know, one thing after another, just the hellfire, damnation. You guys are all, you know, sinful, hateful, angry, you know, whatever. It was that kind of message. Mm-hmm. And my friend said something along the lines of this, and it reminds me to this day. I had to develop this in my own self. He said, "How dare that guy talk about the bride of Christ like that?" Hmm. And I thought, man, I instantly like agreed, but also felt that same conviction. Right. Uh-huh. It's like, man, there's so many times when I'm like bashing the church. The church uh-huh. is the bride of Christ. Like, what do you, I mean, you come into my house and start bashing my wife, we're going to have problems. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we do, is we sit here and we bash each other. We're beating on the mm-hmm. bride of Christ. Like, if you ascribe to that, the way of thinking, that hit me pretty hard. It's mm-hmm. like, realize, okay, there's got to be something else. That's not the enemy, mm-hmm. right? And you even say, when you say something like, you know, Jesus and the church are not the same thing. The church, capital C, what Jesus established, is not the problem. Mm-hmm. That is yeah. essentially oneness with Christ is the church, right? Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be. What is the problem is when we start to idolize and worship methods and forms mm-hmm. that were man-made mm-hmm. As though they represent what the church mm-hmm. is supposed to be, and that there's a whole
that's a whole podcast spiral. In
yeah.
itself.
Yeah.
And I yeah. for one am not equipped.
Well, but and I think to bring it full circle, the point is people aren't the enemy. They might represent something that is ultimately what we have to fight against. But I think it's sort of like, you know, how can I help people understand or see things from a different perspective so that we can fight the real enemy together? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it goes into bus driving mm-hmm. and it goes into, I mean, what are the practical things that we can do to really unite against what the enemy is truly trying to destroy the future that these mm-hmm. kids have. And there's really small practical ways that we can combat that.
That everyday people can do that. Mm-hmm. You're being a part of the solution. I want to go back to a couple of things that you've alluded to. And if you don't feel comfortable, again, we can scrap this. Are you the product of a mended future? You talk about you didn't want to go home as a kid. Are you the product? Have you healed something that you experienced?
Not passing down to your kids.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Man, I hope so. I hope I'm amending futures. I think about it a lot. So, you know, little context, because my family was intact until currently. My dad's actually divorcing my mom after like 45 years. Oh, wow. And so what I tell people is really, this is just sort of the manifestation of probably what has been for the last, I think the timeline might be 25, 30 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. And so my parents just kind of lived together undivorced. I'd always kind of been the black sheep of the family. But like, when I look back on my childhood and I compare it to what my brothers and my sister experienced, it's very different experience. Some of that has to do with me and just the way I process information. But some of it I think has to do with just, I was just different. I was wired differently.
Where are you in the lineup?
I'm the second in line. My sister is older by a year and a half. So I'm the first
boy.
Mm-hmm. And I kind of took on the role of big brother to my sister. Mm-hmm. Out of that space. So I sort of feel like I'm the oldest.
Yep.
For that reason. But yeah, just very different experience. And a lot of it kind of was around, you know, there's a lot of legalism. Again, that chip on the shoulder for Christianity was, you know, it was always, you're not good enough. You're not doing it right. You're doing something wrong. If there's something wrong with my life, it was probably my fault, and you know, that kind of sentiment. And so just naturally, I don't think I processed it as a kid and thought, I don't like that, so I don't want to be home. It was just naturally, I just gravitated to doing whatever I could to be outside the home, because it just wasn't a safe or comfortable environment for me. So obviously now as a parent, I'm like, man, I want to make sure my home is a safe space. I want my kids to want to be here, you know. Actually, it kind of drives me nuts the other direction, because it's like let's go do something else. Let's go somewhere. I mean, we do a lot of stuff. I was like, I love inviting. I don't like having anything that I can't share with other people. I like having other people into our home. I love taking my family into public Easter spaces and spending time with other people. And, you know, my wife and kids are like, well, just us is fine. I'm like, no, I want to share us, you know? So there's a kind of that whole thing, but I'm grateful. Like, how cool is it that the ideal day for my kids is to just be with the family? Mm-hmm. Like, that's wild. It's still uncomfortable for me, and I have to recognize that, you know? But so in that way, I hope that I'm kind of passing on or changing the legacy, you know, that was passed down to me. But the other thing I would say too is, you know, the way you might answer that question, you think about like amended future. You know, I don't have the backstory of like an overtly physically abusive parents, or, you know, drugs and alcohol in a way that can wreak havoc on families. And, you know, I didn't have a lot of that backstory. And, you know, a lot of times we look back, and if you're like me, you know, I was adjacent to a lot of it. The neighborhood I grew up in was a lot of broken families and a lot of abuse and a lot of, you know, stuff. And I was adjacent to it a lot, but I didn't have that myself necessarily. And so I think sometimes we tend to, maybe if you're like me and identify with this, you look back and you go, man, I don't really have a story to tell. And like, man, no. Your story is that there is a better way, that it doesn't have to be like this. Like, you don't, this is my heart and my passion for my God babies, because my God babies came from fatherless homes. I was their father figure. My oldest goddaughter calls me dad, you know, calls my wife mom, you know. My other God babies, like, they call me for advice, or they, and, you know, like, there's this determination I have in their lives to make sure that they don't repeat what they've seen. Mm-hmm. That just because your life was this way doesn't mean it has to stay this way. It doesn't mean you have to pass this on when you start having a family. Like, I want to make sure that they know, my godson, man, is hardworking. He's busting it to be a good provider for his family, but he's got a lot of cycle to break. Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't know his dad. Mm-hmm. He doesn't, you know, and the dad that became his dad was ended up being no good. And so he's like, he's got a lot to overcome, but I'm like determined. I'm going to be the consistent. I call it the love that remains. When it's all said and done, I want to be that one person that you know is going to be there if you need it, mm-hmm. you know, maybe not in the way you need it. You know, the time they'll hit me up for money or something. I'm like, oh, all right, I ain't got no money right now. So, but if you ever just like, they just know they can. And so in that way, mending futures mm-hmm. beyond even my own family for people that I believe have been placed in my charge to play that role. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I'm doing on the bus, honestly. Yeah. I was like, I just want to mend these kids. Let them know that there is, I mean, a lot of it's just, you know, even in the way that I interact, way I discipline, you know, I don't go straight to the referral and write them up. Mm-hmm. I take a lot of extra time mm-hmm. to talk to them.
Relationship building.
To build relationship. And, to call home and talk to parents and to put the ball in their court mm-hmm. and to, because ultimately it's like I'm not their parent and I can't do what they really need for them to grow, but I can invest in the parents mm-hmm. and believe in them and empower them and encourage them to be better parents. And that's better for that kid than for me to just show up every day, you know? Like, so if I can take whatever position I'm in and leverage that to really get to the root of the matter, I think the best way you can mend futures is to empower and equip people who are mending futures and who have that capacity. And that's what I want to do.
So think about the power of the driver's seat. You're doing some of that work from the driver's seat of a bus.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do this work from any seat.
Mm-hmm.
You probably don't even know this, but there's powerful research behind what you just described for your godchildren. That if you are a non-parental adult, if a child can self-report that they have three people who are not their parents who care about them, that they're gonna have more resiliency in life. Because you don't have to care for them. Their bus driver does not have to care for them. Their godfather does not. You don't have to be there.
Yeah.
And it's so powerful when someone who doesn't have to be there is there.
I had that conversation with a young lady on my bus not too long ago where she made some comment about, you know, you only ever call my parents and blah, 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 blah. Like, I'm singling her out. I'm like, first of all, you don't have access to my call records.
Right.
You don't know how many parents I've called. But second of all, if I didn't care, I wouldn't be calling.
Mm-hmm.
It's my time I'm spending. It's my energy I'm expending. You understand? I do not need to do this.
Right.
But I want to because I care about you. So I said something like, you know, I had another interaction where, I was asking about, you know, hey, what's going on? And this girl's like, why are you in my business?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh, maybe because I care.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of left it at that. It was like these kids hear stuff like that. And they're like,
what?
Why?
Mm-hmm.
Why? So I agree. I see that. And I've. You know, my God babies are all, they're 16 and up to like 24, I think my oldest is now 25. Oh my gosh. Anyway, so, you know, they're sort of past like a lot of the earlier phases that we think of like really critical development, mm-hmm. things like that. But even now at 25 years old, you know, I just think there's so much. And then even after all that time, now to hear her call me dad. And to see my grand god babies, you know, she's got these, oh my gosh, you talk about, I mean, now the legacy is like, you just see it and you see her being a great mom mm-hmm. and being very intentional. And dude, it's that's the fuel I need to keep mm-hmm. showing up on the bus every day. Cause I've seen it work. And even as a teacher, I can mm-hmm. tell story after story. I don't know where these kids are now that I used to teach, but had enough interactions where I saw positive things come of it. And I had it. I had coaches mm-hmm. that took me under their wing. To this day, on Father's Day, there are, I believe, 5 different men that I message on Father's mm-hmm. Day to thank them for filling the gap for me and for being a dad to me and showing me what a good dad looked like. Like, dude, I know because I'm a product of mm-hmm. that mended future, what difference that makes when you step into that gap.
And I think that's so important now that I have an almost 15-year-old son. I have a husband who is a great dad and very present. My dad and his dad are very present. Mm. But it is so neat to watch my husband's friends and other mm-hmm. men from our village who do mm-hmm. not have to step in because there's not a need. But he has, I think it would be really interesting to ask my son to identify some of these folks that he could call on, just like people call on you. Mm-hmm. And it is so powerful. And it doesn't take a lot of time. And these men get joy out of, hey, do you want to come work for me today? Mm-hmm. Or I could use your help. Or do you want to ride with me? These are people that he can call if he needs advice or if they have a skill that we don't have. You know, I think it is so incredibly powerful when people and everybody, I always talk about the river, the Vision 30 river. There's a healthy river. There's an unhealthy river. You are standing in the river in a lot of ways, but you're also showing other people along the river that you can be passing out life preservers. You can be walking upstream, finding out why kids are falling in the river. There's a place for you, and it mm-hmm. doesn't have to be complicated. Mm-hmm. I know there are people who are going to listen and say, oh, no way, I will not drive a bus. But mm-hmm. there will be people who listen who realize, wow, I could do X, Y, or Z and be a part of the solution. I could drive a bus. I could work in a school cafeteria. There's so many ways that you can be a mentor and get paid to do it.
Yes. I think that is perhaps one of the greatest perceived barriers to doing things like this is we think it's got to be something grandiose and mm-hmm. something big. Mother Teresa said, my wife actually painted a big canvas. We had this in our house for the longest time. It was up at White Hart for a little while, and now she wants to paint over it, and I have feelings about this. But the saying in a paraphrase is you can do no great things, just great small things with great love. Mm. And obviously Mother Teresa lived that. But I think that that's perhaps one of the most important barriers to address is like, stop trying to do great, like big grandiose things. Just do something small, but do it with great love.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And bring your whole self into whatever situation you're in and pour it out on others. I think that's so many people don't think that they have the capacity or they don't have a story or they don't have whatever. There's always something. And you identify whatever that thing is and just eliminate that barrier and just be fully you. That's authenticity, right? Being mm-hmm. everything you are and nothing that you aren't. Just be that in a space that you're in and watch what happens.
Well, I think that's as good a place to wrap up as
oh my gosh. Yes. do that. what he said.
Go ahead. Is there anything you'd like to say to the people before we wrap up?
The people. Mm-hmm. Saying to the people.
Other than all the wise things you just mm-hmm. said.
Well, if there's anything wise, it didn't come from me. It might have come out of my mouth, but I didn't come up with it. So I would, maybe that's what I would say. It kind of goes back to what we were talking about before the podcast is I just have a real desire for people to understand, not only like what you're capable of in the context that you're in, but you have everything you need to do all you were made to do right now. There's not someday or when I get this degree or when I get this knowledge, like you have everything you need right now. It's in you. And be leery of people that are trying to tell you you don't have it and they do because they're just trying to sell you something, right? Be very careful. You have what you need and you just need the people around you can help you see it. And you need the people around you that can help you discover what it is, like that truth is in you. I mean, I can get even deeper philosophically, theologically with this, but I just know you have it in you. And the only thing keeping you from doing what you were meant to do is you. And got to contend with that first.
No pressure.
No pressure. it's me every day. I have to remind myself. Yep.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. What an honor.
Thank you for listening to the Mended Futures podcast, hosted by Allison Jordan and Taylor Melvin, produced by Liam Chafin, Sue England, Allison Jordan, Robert Day, Sully Jugar, and Taylor Melvin. You can find us on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to like, share, and subscribe to see more.